This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Hasan Minhaj, is a correspondent on The Daily Show. He was hired by Jon Stewart just a few months before Stewart left the show. The Trump administration has provided plenty of material for satire, but it's also created serious concerns for the Minhaj family. His parents are Muslim immigrants from India. On his post-election night piece on The Daily Show, he ended by talking about how his mother, an American citizen, was visiting family in India, and they were worried that a Muslim ban would be instituted that would make it difficult for her to get back home to America. Just a few weeks ago, Minhaj was the MC at the White House Correspondents' Dinner and did stand-up, roasting the president and the press. Usually, the president does stand-up, too, but this year, President Trump declined to attend the dinner. Here's Minhaj at the dinner.
I would say it is an honor to be here, but that would be an alternative fact. It is not. No one wanted to do this. So, of course, it lands in the hands of an immigrant. It's how it always goes down. No one wanted this gig. No one.
Now Hasan Minhaj has a Netflix comedy special called Homecoming King that will be available starting next Tuesday. It's about growing up in Davis, California, the son of immigrants. Let's start with a clip in which he's telling the story of the anonymous threatening phone call his father received at home right after 9/11. Just after the phone call, the windows on the family car were shattered. Hasan Minhaj went out into the street to see if he could find who did it.
I look back in the middle of the street. My dad's in the middle of the road, sweeping glass out of the road like he works at like a hate crime barbershop. Just like, we got customers, we gotta clean this up. Zen, brown Mr. Miyagi, just like not saying a word. I run up to him like, Dad, why aren't you saying something? I'm not asking you now, say something. He looks at me and he goes, Hasan, ye cheez to hote? Or ye cheez hoenge? These things happen, and these things will continue to happen. That's the price we pay for being here. And that's when I was like, oh no, we really are from two different generations. Like BMX bikes aside. Like my dad's from that generation, like a lot of immigrants, where he feels like if you come to this country, you pay this thing like the American dream tax, right? Like you're gonna endure some racism. And if it doesn't cost you your life, well, hey, you lucked out, pay it. There you go, Uncle Sam. But for me, like a lot of us, I was born here. So I actually have the audacity of equality.
That's an excerpt of Homecoming King. Hasan Minhaj, welcome to Fresh Air. I love this new show.
Thanks for having me, Terry.
Can you talk a little bit more about the difference in your point of view about what it means to be an immigrant and a Muslim in America now, and what the difference generationally between your father as an immigrant and you as somebody who was born here?
Yeah, the biggest difference between, and I feel like a lot of third culture kids feel this, and I identify as a third culture kid, meaning that, you know, my family's from Aligarh, India. They immigrated to America. I was born here. I exist in this hyphen. I'm an Indian American Muslim kid, but am I more Indian? Am I more American? What part of my identity am I? And one of the biggest things immigrant kids oftentimes feel is it's this big disparity between our parents and us. Our parents are staunch pragmatists. And we actually, I consider myself to be an optimist, you know. So when my dad immigrated here, we talk about it in the show. There's this thing called, you know, the American dream tax. You're going to come here. You're going to endure some struggles, some problems. But if you don't die, if it doesn't cost you your life, well, hey, you lucked out. My dad is a child of partition when it happened in India. So if I explain the concept of microaggressions to him, he's like, I dealt with full-on aggression. You're lucky. Put your head down and go.
Partition is when Pakistan divided from India, and there was a lot on both sides of this new border. There was a lot of violence and a lot of death.
Yes, and it was one of the largest mass exoduses of people from India to Pakistan. My dad's family stayed in Aligarh in India, which was a huge decision because you're dividing a country based on religious lines. So the things that he saw and witnessed as a kid, he doesn't want to hear about my identity crises at school, you know, and how I want to just, you know, fall in love and fit in. For him, things that he witnessed during that generation and era were very, very extreme and oftentimes violent. But what's weird is, you know, for me as a kid growing up, going to school, taking honors gov in high school and learning about equality and civil liberties, you actually at a young age have this sense of optimism where you're like, oh, so I am equal. That means I shouldn't be treated this way. And that's where there's this big sort of differentiation between us and our parents. And, you know, that night, you know, when I tell that story of September 12th, it was the first night of so many nights where I kind of was put in this position where, do I think like my dad? You know, do I sweep up the glass that's in the road? Do I sort of just forget this hate crime? Do I sweep up the glass that way the neighbors don't see it and just go back inside and actually be grateful that they broke the windows on the car, they didn't break the windows to the house, and try to, you know, come in and do something and just, hey, just count my blessings? Or do I use this as a moment to be like, no, this is wrong, and I should speak up and say something, because it's these moments where maybe my generation can move the needle forward a little bit and talk about this. But I even say it in the show, that pendulum swings back and forth for me all the time. I don't have a clear, you know, that this is the way you deal with this. There's sometimes where maybe my dad's right, and there's sometimes where I'm like, no, I think he's wrong. I think being an angry optimist is the solution.
So there are a lot of cultural differences between you and your father. And let's start with the fact that your father hadn't even met your mother when he decided to marry her. Can you describe the circumstances of their marriage?
My dad was doing grad school, and he was in Uligar. You know, he was of age to get married. And he had heard about this girl named Seema, my mom. And I talk about it in the show, the hype around Seema. She was like the iPhone 8 of Uligar. People were just like, oh my God, have you heard of this girl named Seema? She's very slim and slender, and her family owns a camera. And my dad was like, oh my God, a camera? I can't believe this. You know, so he just, off of just this Yelp review of who she was and what her family was like, he just ran down to my grandfather's house and laid it all on the line. He's just like, what's up? I'm Najmi. I'm a chemist. I'm going to America. Please let me marry Seema. And in 10 minutes, he married a woman he had never laid eyes on. And it's a pretty incredible story when I think about it, because that level of decisiveness is something that I don't have. I'm his son. I don't have that level of decisiveness. But because of that decision, I'm here. And it's pretty wild.
Okay, so he marries your mother without meeting her. You, yes. On the other hand, you were born in 1985. So you grew up with, like, yes. Hip-hop. You know, you grew up with television and movies, but the kind of television and movies where sex is a constant presence. And
sex before
marriage is a constant presence.
Yeah.
And so, again, like, the difference between, like, your father's cultural values growing up in India and your own growing up here are so much at odds with each other. Was it hard for you to, and obviously, like, you wanted to fit in when you were in high school. Was it hard for you to find a place where you could survive at home and be your father's son, but also be the person you wanted to be at school and with your friends?
Yeah. His rules with me growing up were very simple. No fun, no friends, no girlfriends. You can have fun in med school, which is just like a huge lie. I mean, Terry, that's just a blatant lie. It never, you know, you go to a club and you just see a bunch of dudes going crazy. Like, what's going on, fellas? Oh, what's going on? Residency. Like, I'm having the time of my life. It doesn't work like that. But I felt like for my dad, I am his first round draft pick. You know, like, I'm the LeBron James to his franchise. I have to deliver the dream. And, you know, I am aware of that. I go back to Uligar and I go back to Delhi often, where my cousins live now, and I'm very aware of the opportunity that I have when I go meet them. And that's where I understand and I empathize with what my dad feels. And when I was, you know, in high school and trying to meet and talk to girls, go to the movies on a weekend, you know, try to maybe go to, like, some sort of social event, fit in, maybe... I never would invite school friends over to my house. I would go over to, you know, like, my friends' houses. It was just about trying to fit in and find my place in the world, where my dad really felt, look, if you take care of these necessary things, you'll find your place. But I meant that emotionally. I want to find my place emotionally. Where do I belong, you know? And that was a tough thing for him to understand.
So was comedy like a secret weapon for you in school, like a way for you to be yourself and stand out? And what did your father think of comedy?
In high school, I didn't know what comedy was, but I was involved in speech and debate and public speaking.
Close. And impromptu speaking. Close.
Yeah. But
debate club, stand up. Yeah.
But no, actually, believe it or not,
they are close.
They are very similar. When I got to college, that's when I was first exposed to stand-up comedy. Again, I didn't know what it was. My parents didn't let us have cable television. So I thought stand-up comedy was the stuff that Seinfeld did before Seinfeld, where he's just like, hey, you ever notice, like, what's with the deal with laundry? And I was always like, I hate that part of Seinfeld. Like, get to the episode. Then when I get to college, I get exposed to Pryor, Bring the Pain, Chris, all this like really edgy, subversive stuff, all this stuff that I could never say in my house or at school. They're being critical of the government. I mean, they're really being provocative. Carlin, these guys are really pushing the edge. And that's when I realized, oh, that's funny speech and debate. Like, my favorite comedians are just presenting an argument, and they're doing it in a funny way. And whenever I would do speech and debate, forensics, or, like, there was a division called just impromptu speaking, you're given a topic. If you can make the judges laugh, or if you could ridicule your opponent's position and make the judges laugh, I always would do better on the scorecard. So when I had this sort of, oh, my God, like, that's it. I've been doing that. Like, I know how to do that. And that's when I really wanted to get into comedy and sort of like political comedy and talk about a lot of these topics that sometimes would be too taboo to talk about in other settings.
I guess that was good practice for The Daily Show.
Yeah, inadvertently. Yeah, that's essentially put together a 3.5 or 4 minute chat. That's what, you know, forensics was.
Wow. Let's talk about your mother. We talked about how your father decided to marry your mother through kind of hearing about her through word of mouth and seeing a picture. So they got married. They moved to the States, but she went right back to India soon after because she was studying medicine and wanted to complete med school there. So basically for the first 8 years of your life, you were brought up by your father with occasional visits from your mother.
Yes. Yes.
So how much did you know about her for the first 8 years of your life?
You know, I definitely knew about her. And as I was growing up, you know, she got an opportunity to do residency and rotations in New York and then in Stockton. So over the course of my life, she moved closer and closer to us. But so I would see her. But it was one of those things where growing up with an Indian father who's super strict, and then my mom, who was just sort of the antithesis to him, that made it really bittersweet because I really wanted to be around my mom. And it's tough being just a kid growing up with an immigrant father and not having that buffer to be there as much, you know? It was really hard. It was hard.
Yeah. So when your mother returned for good to your home and the family was reunited, the family suddenly got much larger because your mother brought with her a 5-year-old girl who you were told was your sister, the sister you'd never met because your mother and father conceived your sister in India during one of his visits to India to visit your mother. So you were kind of stunned when you found out that you had this sister that nobody ever told you about. Why didn't they tell you?
I think it's one of those things where, okay, this is an important piece of information, but obviously, you know, it's finessed for the one-man show format. My younger sister, Aisha, was born in the States, and then at 2 months after her birth, she went to go live with my grandparents and be raised there. So I didn't officially, you know, get a chance to really meet her until I was 8, you know? And so that, I think, you know, the tough thing was, again, a lot of immigrant households, when you come to the States, you don't have the sort of bandwidth and setup to accommodate a lot of things. You know, my dad is working full time. I'm at school, and then I'm going to preschool and sort of an after school daycare program. And now we have a newborn, my little sister. My mom is doing residency and rotations. So she's at a hospital all day. There just wasn't that infrastructure to care for this newborn baby, and also financially, potentially, you know, that wasn't there. My grandparents were in India, and it was set up in such a way that way she could be raised, and she was around cousins, and it was an amazing way for her to grow up. Our narratives are very different. She grew up in India, like literally it took a village. She was around people that loved her and were there for her. And I was this brown kid who was alone in America with his dad. And so when she came back, I was just like, I hate this person. Like, who are you? I just want a mom. Now I got you.
So I'm going to stop you here because we have a clip from your show Homecoming King in which you talk about how you felt about your sister as this kind of like intruder in your life when she came to live with you. So let's hear that clip. And this is Hasan Minhaj from his new Netflix comedy special, Homecoming King.
I hated that brown girl so much. Can I be honest with you guys? I totally understood the wall. I was like, build that wall. I was like a little Republican. I get it. I remember leveling with my parents at the dinner table. I was like, look, mom, dad, let's just be real. Oh my God, these brown people, oh geez. Coming into our house, eating our fruit roll-ups. They don't speak the language. I say we tell them to go back to where they came from. That's just me. He's like, Hasan, you can't say that. We're family. We're all that we have. I'm like, nah, that's on you and mom. Like, you guys decided to get your Angelina Jolie on and bring over this fob in a frock. That's on you. That's not on me.
Okay, that's Hasan Minhaj from his new one-man show, Homecoming King, which will be up on Netflix May 23rd. So you describe in your show that you took all the anger channeled at you, all the anger channeled at you because you're brown and Muslim, and you channeled it at your new sister. How did you realize that you were doing that?
I didn't realize how messed up it was until there was this incident where, you know, I wanted to be treated special in a certain way. And then when my sister got there, my dad took a lot of that guilt and not being able to be there the first several years of her life, missing her first steps, her first words, all of those things. And he got her this gift that I always wanted, this blue BMX bike that I had wanted. It was in the Toys R Us Kids catalog, and I had this cutout on my wall. And then for her fifth birthday, he brings everybody in the living room, and he gives her this bike. And I stole that bike from her, and I took it around the block, even though she lent it to me. She's like, you can take it out for the first ride. And I took it, and I popped a wheelie, and I actually fell off the bike, and I messed up the bike. It, like, fell over, and all the blue paint got, like, chipped off the side of the bike, and I remember her running over and just crying, bawling. And I remember looking down at her and being like, wow, like, this is really messed up. I resent this girl. I hate her. She's like my foil. But I've been looking for acceptance from everyone at school, and she's just wanted to hang out with. That's all she wants. She just wants to be around me. She wants me to teach her about America and teach her English, and she just wants to be my best friend. What am I doing? And it was sort of this moment where I remember finally kind of realizing, it was the first time where I realized maybe family and looking out for one another is an important thing. Like, it's right here underneath my nose, and I should value it.
Did your father change? Did he become something of a different person when your mother moved back?
He became a much softer person when my mom and Aisha came back. I can just, you know, and I can still see it in his eyes. You know, when he looks at my sister, there is this, like, deep affection and this, it's just so much like love. I remember when Aisha first came back and she was wearing this, like, white frock, and she had, like, her hair in this ponytail. She was done up like this little, like, brown porcelain doll. And I remember my dad, you know, he had, like, tears in his eyes. He was so happy to see her and have her be in the house and sleep, like, me and her, we shared a bedroom, like, for us to be in one room together. It really made him happy. I think it's a regret he still has to this day that he didn't get a chance to be a part of the early part of her life. And when she got here, it definitely made him a lot softer to her and my mom. You know, they were in the house. But what's weird is it made him super soft with them, but he doubled down with me. Like, he wanted me to be the protector, and he wanted me to go from Simba to Mufasa really fast. And I wasn't ready for that.
You talk about immigrants liking secrets, and certainly your father.
Yeah.
You put your father in that category. So when you decided to become a comic and talk about yourself, did you have to fight your own instincts? Because I'm sure he instilled in you an instinct to be secretive, but you were defying that instinct.
Yeah. When I first started doing stand-up, I kept it kind of generic. Oh, these are some tropes. This is what it's like, you know, growing up in my life. And I was afraid for the longest time. And I was afraid of this theme that, you know, we talk about a lot in immigrant households. Lo que hacen, what will people think? I just was afraid if I get too real, if I get too honest on stage, people aren't going to like it. They're going to think I'm a freak. The first several years of me doing comedy, it was me hiding comedy from my parents. And then me also hiding who I really, really am to the audience. It was almost like I was on the playground all over again. And it wasn't until I started exploring the personal stuff, the one-man show stuff, that I kind of got a chance to be more open to the audience and to my family.
How did you start doing that?
It was inadvertent. I got asked to do a Moth Story Slam. It was at a comedy festival. The lineup was all comedians. And the theme was love and heartbreak. I'm driving to the gig, and I just look at my email, and I have to think of a 10-minute story for the slam. And I had to think of my first moment of love and heartbreak. And I couldn't lean back on my act, so I had to be honest. So I ended up telling a story about being in high school and my first love, and that became the seed of the idea of what is Homecoming King.
So you tell a story in your show about how you were about to perform at the Comedy Store in New York. When your sister calls you that your father is about to have a quintuple bypass after having, did he have a heart attack before that?
A heart attack. He had a heart attack.
So
it was it was the Comedy Store in L.A.
Oh, in L.A. Okay, yeah, so you're closer to his home than I thought.
I'm closer to home, I'm living in Los Angeles at the time. I get a call from my sister, Hassan Bhai, come home. Dad had a heart attack. You need to come home now.
Right, because your family was living in Davis, California.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So you do your show. Mm-hmm. At the Comedy Store, then you go to be with your father. So what was the calculus you did in your mind to decide whether you should cancel your show and just leave or do the show first and then go? That strikes me as a really hard choice that you made.
Yeah.
One I'm not sure you were happy with. But...
Yeah, I'm not. I'm still not happy with it. Sorry, it's just like... It was a very ugly thing. I love my dad a lot, you know, and it's something I'm not very proud of, but I was very, very angry at that time. I was living in LA and I'm pursuing comedy on my own terms. My parents, specifically my dad, wasn't very, you know, supportive of it. And I remember when I got the call to go home. My sister was really worried, and I was just thinking, yeah, I got to do this set. And in my head, it was basically just like, you know, this is my time now. Nobody can tell me what to do. No one's going to control whether I can leave the house or not. He doesn't get it, but I'll come home after the set. And I'm very embarrassed that I made that choice. It was just...
Don't you think in a way sometimes that the tighter a parent's grip is, the more like you have to just like double down when you're breaking away and like demand like, no, I'm drawing the line. You know, and
but
you sometimes
in the face
do,
of a
like,
heart attack, I mean...
No, I know. And you sometimes do things that you're not proud of as a result. But I do think that is a phenomenon. Do you know what I mean? That when a parent holds on tight, it's so hard to kind of break away and become the person you want to be that you sometimes do some really...
Yeah.
Like stupid, just, even dangerous things.
It was just a kind of ugly thing, you know, because I knew better. But yeah, in that moment, it's just... I was feeling that grip for so many years that you finally sort of feel free. And you just want to be your own person and make your own choices in spite of that. And I decided to do a set, and I've done thousands of sets, but that night I decided to do that set because it was almost just like defiant in a weird, in a strange way, to be like, no, I'm gonna come home on my own terms, and you know, there's nothing you can do about it. And
but you talk about when you did come home and you saw your father, and you said goodbye to him before the surgery, before the bypass, and you thought, if he dies, like if something happens to him, I will never have really gotten to know him.
Yeah.
And you talk about how you decided then that you'd better really get to know him as a person better. And it sounds like you did. What did you do to be able to do that? Because as somebody who you've described as keeping secrets and not being forthcoming with you, how did you change the terms of your relationship?
I was forced to. I don't think it was as much of an act of bravery and courage as it was he had to sit and recover in the hospital. I'm a full-time stand-up comedian. My sister and my mom actually have real jobs. So I'm just forced to sit and talk to him in this hospital room. And you run out of stories. There's only so much Wheel of Fortune you can watch. And so I started telling him stories about my life, and he started telling me stories about his life, because we just were together all day for weeks. So I was able to start to piecemeal things about his life, and he started to hear stories from my life. And that's how we were able to sort of bridge that divide. And I realized a lot of the things that he was keeping secret, he just didn't want me to worry about, you know? He
like
just
what?
Was like, I mean, things like, why didn't you ever tell me how you met Mom? Or why didn't you guys tell me more about the Aisha stuff? Logistically, why didn't you just talk to me about it? And, you know, my dad was actually really honest. He was like, I could tell when I would look at you, you were having a tough time at school. You were having a tough time fitting in. If we dangle that over your head, you know, you actually have a sibling. You actually have a sidekick who looks like you, who has the same skin color as you, who you could share a lot of these experiences with. Oh, but she's in India. It would break your heart to have that reminder be dangled over your head. You know, they're just like, I kept that information from you so that maybe you'd be safe or things would be easier. The thing that I kind of told him, and, you know, he said the same thing about me. Why would you keep all these things from me? I had the same reasoning with him and Mom. I didn't tell them about sneaking out of the house or falling in love or kissing a girl or trying to go to prom, all of those things, because I didn't want them to worry. But everybody's worrying about what other people will think. The truth is still the truth, and it's the most powerful thing you can share with the person that you love. So it wasn't until, you know, my dad and my family seeing death that we had to be like, all right, we got to be on the same page and we got to talk about this stuff.
Is your father well now?
Yeah, he's doing much better. He's doing much better. You know, it's one of those things where he's not a big guy. So having that many arteries clogged, quintuple bypass, it was a big change on his life. You know, it's never been the same. And it's a very humbling procedure. They saw your chest open. They open you up. And so that scar is still on his chest, and I still see it. You know, it's one of those things where you can still see the stitches that go all the way up to his neck. It's one of those things where it's a reminder of, you know, your parents' mortality.
Yeah, and I imagine since your father had such control over your life in some ways, or at least tried to have it when you were growing up, to see his mortality, to see his vulnerability, because I know what it's like to have a father who's recovering from bypass, and like in that first period, like you are so vulnerable and so weak, and for a lot of people, they lose a lot of their memory for a while.
Yeah.
And so like it's very upsetting, and you never know for sure how much are they going to be able to become the person who you knew. How much will they get back to that place?
That guy who would just sort of rule the house, rule over me specifically with an iron fist. he's helpless in this Kaiser hospital bed. It was just too weird. And it's so bizarre that for years I wished he wasn't so stern and had, you know, I was like, oh God, one day if Dad just didn't have the energy to always criticize me. And then that day I'm sitting with him in the hospital and I'm like, I wish he had the energy to criticize me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just a trip, you know?
There's a moment in your show that I really love, and I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of moments I really love, but I'm going to mention this one. You talk about how you auditioned for The Daily Show and how you got job and everything.
Right.
And then you say to Jon Stewart, John, my dad knows you. And I love that because your father probably had no frame of reference for any of the comedy you were doing or for any of your comedy heroes. Nothing.
Yeah.
But I guess he knew The Daily Show?
Yeah. The Daily Show oddly became the current equivalent of journalism. He actually would see clips of it, and he held John in the same esteem that he would hold, you know, Dan Rather. So to him, he was like, oh, this is a guy who's actually doing something good for society. And I would, you know, sometimes tell him, you know, Dad, you know, John was a stand-up comedian. He's like, no. This guy, he's a news anchor. He's just funny. I mean, he doesn't tell jokes to drunk people at 2 o'clock in the morning. That's what you do. This guy's not a clown. He's a real, you know, the real deal. And so when I had that moment when I got the job, I wanted to share that Oscar speech with John, but all I could say was like, my dad knows you. And he's like, all right, I'm sure he does. All right, man, I'll see you later. Like, John doesn't understand the magnitude of what that meant, but for me, it was a huge deal. I had been doing stand-up 10 years, 1 month, and 9 days. And to finally have something where your parents know what it is, it meant everything to me.
So let's change directions a little bit here.
Yeah.
On The Daily Show, you did a piece at the Republican National Convention about the proposed Muslim ban and the proposed deportation of Muslims, things Donald Trump was talking about. So you interviewed people at the convention with these delegates that you were talking to?
Yeah, these were delegates. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this was a field piece for The Daily Show, and I want to play some of the conversations you were having with delegates. So here's Hasan Minhaj.
What's the best thing about Oklahoma?
The Oklahoma Sooners.
Well, we call it Maui no ka oi, which means Maui is the best.
Wow, I would love to go there sometime.
You're always welcome to come.
I would love to come down and see a game.
Yes, come.
I can't.
Why?
I'm a Muslim, and if Donald Trump is elected, he's probably going to throw me out.
Oh, I don't think so.
Well, he has already asked for a complete and total shutdown of Muslims entering the country, and he's asked for American Muslims to sign up for a registry.
Well, you kind of have to understand a little bit of where he's coming from.
Where he's coming from? Maybe someplace like this?
You told CNN, quote, Islam hates us. Did you mean all 1.6 billion Muslims?
I mean a lot of them. I mean a lot of them.
But for some reason, Republicans don't seem too worried.
He's a guy that shoots off the hip and says things politically incorrect, kind of wild guy.
Sometimes the racist stuff just comes right off the hip.
Comes off the hip, yeah.
What can you do? Bang, bang.
Bang, bang.
Donald Trump isn't going to kick the Muslims out of the United States.
Well, you think he's going to be nicer to Muslims?
I don't know what Donald Trump's going to do. You never know what Donald Trump's going to do, right?
That's what I'm scared about.
Okay, that's Hasan Minhaj doing a piece at the Republican National Convention for The Daily Show. After the election, you did a piece on The Daily Show.
Yeah.
And it ended with you talking about how your mother, at that moment, was in India visiting family. And she called you and said to you, do you think it's safe for me to come home? You know, do you think I'll be able to come home back to America? And you said, I don't know. It sounds like it was a horrible, frightening moment for you. What was the outcome of that?
We got her home ASAP because I didn't know. We were doing a live show that night. It was our election night special. We had a script written that was, you know, it followed what we thought was going to happen, that Hillary Clinton would be president. As the results were coming in, we're literally tearing apart our script. We're rewriting a one-hour live show in real time. And I'm on WhatsApp audio with my mom. My mom being like, we're watching the news. I'm with your grandma. What's going on? And so I'm trying to write jokes about
Trump winning the election while I'm on kayak.com, like looking up tickets for her to come back. I'm also looking up, like, what's the legal recourse? How does it work? All of a sudden, I have to become an immigration attorney, a son, and a comedian all in one. It was just, it was a horrible 48 hours. It was the worst. It was the worst. And not knowing that everything will be okay was just really awful. It was really, really awful.
But you managed to get her home.
We did. We did. We managed to get her home before the Muslim ban happened, too. I didn't want to risk anything. Like, mm-hmm. we got her home. She was supposed to be there for several months, and we just got her home ASAP.
So I want to ask you about the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which is an annual dinner. And it's in part a roast of the president and of the media, in which a guest comic like you is invited to be the host and the roaster. And then usually in the past few presidencies, you know, the president gets up and does comedy, too. And that usually turns into a roast as well. But this year, you know, President Trump decided not to go the day of the White House Correspondents' Dinner. He chose to do a rally in Pennsylvania.
Yes.
And so you were in the position of making jokes about a president who decided not to attend. You say in your monologue, nobody wanted this job this time around. So, of course, it went to an immigrant. But is it true that nobody wanted the job? Did a lot of people turn it down because...
What were the reasons that they turned it down? Public, you know. James Corden had passed on it. Mm-hmm. Quite a few, you know, comedians were in talks to do it. It was this really, really strange hot potato situation. So the narrative going into the dinner was, is the dinner even going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I got the call to do it, it was about 3 weeks before the event, which was April 29th. And it was one of those things where I did my research and I found out that, wait, the White House Correspondents Association is just a group of journalists who cover the White House. Like, they're not King Joffrey's goons. they don't work for the president. So all those people that you see in those press briefings that are fighting every day with the administration, April Ryans, all of that, they are part of that group, that collection of journalists that are trying to do a good job. Number two, I didn't know this either. They give scholarships to students, like future journalists. So what really bummed me out was, wow, so all these celebrities pulled out. All these other news media organizations don't want to be here. If there was any year to be there, this is the year. This is the year where fighting for free speech and fighting for an open press, this is the year to fight for it. And so when I got asked to do it, I was like, I think this could be a really interesting opportunity. I was scared, but I think it could be really, really interesting. And I could have something to say.
You say in your monologue at the White House Correspondents' Dinner that you were told not to roast the president in absentia. Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah. When I was announced, Jeff Mason went on Morning Joe, and he said he was not looking for somebody who's going to roast the president in absentia. That's not fair, and that's not the message that we want to get across. That was his quote, you know? And if you look at the original press release, he reiterates the same point. When we would talk on the phone, he was... And I understand where the White House Correspondents Association was coming from. They're put in such a weird position because, again, I'm the comedian. I can come in and make jokes, but they have to deal with the administration every single day. And we weren't even on day 100 by the time, like, it was day 100 by the time the event was happening. So, you know, I understand where he was coming from, but the irony to me was, The theme of the night was about honoring the First Amendment. And you want me to, like, censor myself. That, to me, just, I couldn't do it. I just couldn't find myself to do it. Especially in given the fact that the person that I'm roasting, the president, is someone who has so exploited that incredible privilege of free speech. The man who tweets whatever enters his head doesn't even want to honor the amendment that allows him to do it. That, to me, just blows my mind. So I wanted to make the conscious choice of, hey, I will roast his merit and I will roast the decisions he's made, but I have to talk about this.
So let's hear how you handled it. And this is the section of the White House Correspondents' Dinner. We were actually making some jokes about President Trump.
You know, a lot of people told me, Hassan, if you go after the administration, it would be petty, unfair, and childish. In other words, presidential. So here we go. I get why Donald Trump didn't want to be roasted tonight. By the looks of him, he's been roasting nonstop for the past 70 years. Historically, the president usually performs at the Correspondents' Dinner, but I think I speak for all of us when I say he's done far too much bombing this month. Now, a lot of people in the media say that Donald Trump goes golfing too much. You guys are always like, he goes golfing too much, which raises a very important question. Why do you care? Do you want to know what he's not doing when he's golfing? Being president. Let the man putt-putt. Keep him distracted. Teach him how to play badminton. Tell him he has a great body for bobsledding. Play him tic-tac-toe. The longer you keep him distracted, the longer we're not at war with North Korea.
And that's Hassan Minhaj recently at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. When you hear groans like we did after some of your jokes, do you take that as a good thing?
After the fact, yes. When you're in the room, no. And
that is a tough room.
Oh, my God. It's the toughest show I've ever done in my life. It's really, really hard. You have been invited to their dinner. It's a dinner for journalists, honoring journalists. And then you come in at the end and you make fun of them. So it's very difficult. Also, you know, there's representatives on both sides of the aisle. So there's a lot of groans in places that you normally wouldn't get groans. I worked on the set in comedy clubs and people were cheering and wooing. That's not what I got when I got in that room. But the piece of advice that I got from Larry Wilmore and a lot of the other performers that had performed before me was, hey, it's going to be one of the strangest rooms you've ever done. Keep your foot on the gas and do not apologize. And I figured if I can just get to my closing statement where I talked about what it feels like to be a minority, they would actually see I'm coming from a good place because the importance of great journalism is more important now more than ever. And if I can frame it through my cognitive framework of being a minority in America and being like, hey, look, this is what it's like to be brown in America. And if you want to survive the age of Trump, you got to think like a minority because that's the way journalists are being treated. You know, you got to be twice as good for half the credit. When one of you messes up, they blame the entire group. This is what I've dealt with. So here's my advice. You know, and I think that that became a unifying point.
Hassan Minhaj, it's been really great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Terry. I appreciate it.
Hassan Minhaj is a correspondent for The Daily Show. His comedy special, Homecoming King, will be available on Netflix starting next Tuesday.